support comes from Tub Cove. With over 49 years of remodeling bathrooms, Tub Cove can help simplify the process, offering tub and shower replacements and full bathroom remodels. Local and family-owned, with a showroom in Redmond. Designs and information at tubcove.com.
Welcome to Friday, and welcome to Week in Review. I'm Mike Lewis, in for Bill Radke. Joining us today are Executive Director of Commute Seattle, Alex Hudson.
Hello.
Alex, welcome to the show. Vice President for Research at the Washington Policy Center, Paul Guppy. Paul, welcome.
Hi, great to be here.
And, of course, Seattle Times reporter David Croman. David, as always, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, to watch us live on YouTube, search KUOW. And before we get to the news, we got a sweet little segment at the end of the show. Instead of letting the panelists pick their own smile this week, they've been assigned one, the same one. They've all been tasked with suggesting a name for Washington's newest apple, and KUOW listeners have contributed their ideas as well. That's coming up at the end of the show. And no, you cannot have Apple McAppleface. That one is mine. On with the news. Seattle City Council's most recent economic forecast indicates lean times ahead, with reduced sales and business taxes likely to lead to a $240 million deficit for 2025. As the Seattle Times reports, construction is slowing, employment growth is marginal, and this is giving a budget headache to the City Council and Mayor. And it's those construction, trade, and retail taxes that account for more than half of the city's sales tax. Thankfully, right here, we have the messenger who brought all of this bad news to the show, David Croman. David, what do you have to say for yourself?
I'll blame the Office of Revenue and Economic Forecast.
For not having rosier for our forecasts?
I don't think it's this. None of this is really new. I mean, they've known that they're facing this budget deficit for a little while now. I think there was maybe some hope that the updated forecast would bring a little good news and some relief. It seems like occasionally that happens at the state level, at least, that the forecasts end up being rosier than what people expected. Seattle, though, because it's so heavily dependent on sales tax and business and occupation tax, it was just not in the cards that it was going to be an improvement. So, the news they got is the news they had, which was construction in particular is really slowing down and projected to continue to slow down, and office vacancies are expected to continue to rise until they get better. So that is a huge chunk out of the sales tax revenue that comes in. At the end of last year, they were surprised by the dip in sales tax on just like purchases, and they were not expecting it to go down as quickly as it did in late 2023. So that was kind of bad news. You mentioned hiring. You know, Seattle saw employment growth, but it was slower than national growth, partially because we're so tech dependent and the tech industry is slowed down. So all of that put together means the bad news they already had is still the bad news that they have.
And for people not familiar with the size of Seattle's city budget, I mean, how significant is I'm assuming it's very significant, but how significant is $240 million in shortfall?
Well, it's significant. I mean, Seattle's budget is, you know, something like $7 billion, but that is not the real amount that they're working with. The real amount is closer to over a billion. I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but because most of that $7 billion is Seattle Public Utilities, Seattle City Light, money for SDOT, you know, untouchable funds that you can't cut. So that leaves basically the general fund. And so then within the general, you know, if you're looking at a little over $1 billion, then within that general fund, a lot of that is public safety. So Seattle Fire Department, Seattle Police Department. We know the city council is not interested in touching the Seattle Police Department's budget. Seattle Fire Department, that is probably off
Sorry to interrupt, but is the new potential new, it hasn't been ratified yet, but the new contract, which is a lot of back pay, I mean, is that going to affect all of this as well? I mean, is this number including that, or is this number not including that?
No, this number's not including that. Okay. We don't know. We know that the police officers are going to get a retroactive 23% raise, and we could do the math on that for what that works out in real dollars. What we don't know, though, is how much the city has put in reserves in anticipation of that, because, you know, this contract has been expired for a few years, so they've been putting away some money every year in anticipation of it. But, you know, they also just ratified a big contract with all the other city unions. And with that one, they had not put enough away. So that added about $10 million to the deficit. This is a pretty significant raise that the Seattle police officers are considering. They haven't voted on it yet. And so my expectation is whatever reserves they have would probably not be enough to cover it, in which case you can – I think it's a decent bet that the deficit is going to grow further.
Go higher than that.
Yeah.
Paul, so you are given the chance now to find out where that money is going to come from and what programs. What do you do?
My favorite topic is crunching budget numbers and analyzing public budgets. So here we go. Well, one observation is that every budget, public or private, has two sides, a revenue side and a spending side. And politically, Seattle tends to focus only on the revenue side. Why aren't we getting more money out of the public, out of the business community, out of working people, property owners? And I certainly think that most people in Seattle would recognize that they're, and even feel like they're doing their part. So the city has sales taxes over 10%. Property taxes have gone up quite a bit, which is sticker shock for a lot of homeowners, especially on fixed incomes. So the interesting thing about going through a line-by-line analysis of a budget is to look at, well, where is all this money going? David's right. The total budget for the city is $7.4 billion, which is a huge number. But the operating budget, which is where they have the flexibility, is considerably smaller than that. So my advice to the city would be to step back, look at long-term factors that you see coming, like this new police contract that was negotiated, and then really examine where existing revenue is going and seeing how you could fill the gap that way.
Alex, in that area that's discretionary in the budget, the places where the city can cut, I mean, what would be your fears that the city would start looking at first, given the lack? There's clearly going to be cuts somewhere, or there's going to be a massive deficit. Where would you what would be your biggest concern as far as where a cut could happen?
Yeah, social and human services. At the top of this show, we talked about how we can't even keep our libraries open all the time. And so these cuts are already coming, and people are going to feel them in the services, benefits, resources that they expect from the city. In the past, we've seen things like furloughs, right? That has a customer service impact on what people right. can get and expect in terms of permitting and other access to social services. And we know that that is, you know, penny wise and pound foolish to start making cuts into things like social and human services, which really are a protective factor for even more kind of costly things down the road, right? A lot of prevention that we can be doing there. So there's cuts. There's also, you know, revenue and certainly, the city council has not talked about increases to revenue, though I do think many of them spoke positively about the capital gains tax as a potential, should we still have that after November. But I also think it's important to talk about, like, why? Why are these things down? Why is sales tax down? And what can we be doing to kind of make better use of our dollars without having to make these cuts? And so I think about things like, how do we heat up the economy? How do we invest in downtown so that there's less retail vacancy and we've got more money pouring through our economic engine? How can we cut the cost of construction through permitting and regulatory reform that makes it easier, faster, cheaper to be building housing so that the city can be making sure that the economy itself is humming before we have to go and start talking about, you know, how many more library hours people in the city of Seattle aren't going to get.
I would second that, because one thing, again, the wonky line-by-line budget crunching, one temptation is to look at cutting essential services that are visible to the public, where the smart way to start is in structural operations within the city, which, again, is politically hard because of interests. But that is really the best way to find savings, is what are the built-in structural policies and costs that make it expensive for the city to do anything.
Give me an example of a structural policy.
Well, the tough thing is like compensation, pensions, benefits, the size of the workforce, the payroll, just the number of people who are supported by the public taxpayer. And again, these are very difficult decisions to go through, but I think it's smarter to do that instead of right away going to those essential visible services, social services, homeless programs, libraries, parks, things that make this a great city to live in, should not be first on the list to be reduced when there's a gap.
David, let me ask you a question. So we were also going to talk about, I guess I can dovetail into this slightly, but City Council President Sarah Nelson has a new work from work declaration, which requires council staff to return to the office. Obviously, City of Seattle doesn't have a similar policy. That is, I think, on a case-by-case basis. But do you think that the pressure, maybe through business, but certainly through the city, to bring people back to downtown is going to ramp up as a result of, let's just say, increasing downtown revitalization, increasing downtown revenue, or do you think that these are pretty disassociated?
Yeah, I mean, the
it's
the
city, a small number of people understood, you know.
Right, yeah.
Council staff.
Council President Nelson, I mean, she has jurisdiction over the legislative branch, which is, right, as you said, fairly small.
Right.
I think that decision has more to do with the functioning of the city council than it does the vibrancy of downtown.
Right.
The mayor, though, has, you know, purview over the basically everybody else, so 11,000 or so workers. And there is a, you know, I think they're supposed to be in the office 2 to 3 days a week. And I do think that that probably has something to do with sort of trying to bring some vibrancy down to that part of the city. Yeah, I mean, I think they, as we talked about, you know, one of the big things that's vexing them is that not only have office vacancies sort of stagnated, they are probably going to get worse this year before they get better. And so that, and which is, you know, dragging down their commercial sales tax revenue. And so, yeah, that's a real problem. And to Alex's point, I think some downtown vibrancy would probably increase the amount of money coming into their coffers. I will say that there's one wrinkle to this sort of revenue picture, which is the payroll tax that was passed in 2020 on fewer than 100 sort of large companies in Seattle.
7 million or more in payroll, something along those lines.
Yeah, I think that's the number. So that, you know, the business and occupation and sales tax, those are expected to, you know, stagnate or even go down a little bit. The payroll tax, meanwhile, is forecasting way higher than what they had originally thought it would. So when it was passed, it was sort of maybe $250 million. Now next year, they're looking at $400 million. It's a very volatile tax because it's based on the stock prices of basically these fewer than 100 companies. So if the stocks go down, so does the tax. But I think one temptation for the city council is going to be – oh, and I should say that payroll tax in theory is supposed to be reserved for affordable housing and building affordable housing and then a little bit of environmental stuff.
But is that actually delineated in the language or –
It isn't delineated in the language,
but around?
It's delineated in the language. But unlike, say, certain transportation funds or utility funds, it's not like legally and forever bound. Like the city council could make some moves and move that money. In fact, they already have. Last year, they used a portion of that payroll tax to plug the budget gap. So, housing providers and housing developers, of course, do not want that fund to be raided because, you know, of course, they make the argument, and it's a true one, that Seattle needs more affordable housing. But I think with that, the forecast of that being as good as it is, and this city council perhaps not feeling as bound to the parameters that were set by the previous city council on that, I think that that's likely to be part of the conversation too, is that going to be used to help plug this budget deficit?
Well, and also as a big factor, we sort of brushed against this earlier in the city budget, is going to be hiring more police officers. I mean, the promises and incentive programs to the contrary, Seattle police officer recruitment lags behind what the mayor's office wanted. It appears that the new hire and transfer bonuses have not had much of an effect on the numbers. And as a result, the mayor's office is considering one interesting approach to securing more officers, making the test easier. David, we're going to start with you again because you're familiar with this. Can you explain what's going on here?
Yeah, it's all very wonky, and it feels a little bit like minutia. But as Council President Sarah Nelson said yesterday, you know, it feels like minutia, but it is important. I mean, it's such a big and difficult problem, the problem of police recruitment, and it's one that basically any big city right now is facing. I think one thing that the Seattle City Council feels like they have some control over is, are we converting applicants to police officers? The answer right now is basically no.
And what's the ratio of that?
Like 3%. So, which has actually been about the rate for the last decade. But the problem is 3% of 4,000 applicants, as it was in 2013, is quite a bit more than 3% of 2,000 applicants, which is what it is now.
Right.
And so they're hoping to sort of increase that number. And one thing they're looking at is switching to a different test, one that's used, a different entry-level test, one that's used by more local departments, whereas the one that the Seattle Police Department uses now is used by more kind of big West Coast departments like LA and San Francisco. The thought is, you know, if you use the same test as nearby departments, applicants are more likely to just, you know, check the Seattle box and have their test score sent to Seattle in addition to all these other local departments. Mm-hmm. The concern is that this test has a much higher passage rate than the one that they use now. And so, you know, I mean, I think the balance through this whole recruitment conversation is how do you increase the number of officers coming into the department without sacrificing standards? Because, you know, this department still is under federal oversight. Reform and accountability is a big part of what they're trying to do. So how do you bring in more people, but also feel confident that those people are going to, you know, buy into the program?
Alex, let me ask you then, if we switch to a test that more people can pass, do you feel like that's a decent or good technique to, you know, expand the ranks of people who are eligible to become police officers in Seattle?
Depends on the test, right? And so, I'm certainly not in the minutiae at that level. And so the question to me is like, okay, maybe not how do you turn 3% into 6%, but how do you turn through 2,000 into 4,000?
Right, yeah.
And so why are we getting half as few applicants is really a question to me. And I think one of the challenges that I would love to see our police department rise to is to assert that they're going to have just that the highest standard of accountability and just a perfectly clean reputation. And I think there's just been far too many stories and incidences recently about police officers just not hitting that gold standard around accountability and trust in the public that makes it hard for young people who want to serve their community, who want to be police officers, to look at this department and say, hey, those are my future colleagues.
Right.
And so I think that by, you know, not shifting on those issues, not diminishing our overall kind of quality of our police department, by actually increasing that, we may be able to solve this problem.
Paul, how do you see the issue?
Well, like a lot of professions, policing, law enforcement is a national market. And so Seattle is competing not only with other large cities, but you have to think about sort of the safety, working conditions, and lifestyle of the person who wants to maybe move to Seattle, graduates from the police academy, and is looking for a job, filling out the application, taking the test. But what Seattle faces is competing with other communities as being a welcoming environment to professional policing. I agree 100% that high ethical standards and professionalism creates a kind of pride in the police force, and we want to maintain that. That's how you attract the best people. But we also have to recognize that Seattle's reputation has been harmed by the defund movement and by the disruptions and riots that happened in 2020, and it just is not a good look for the city. So then when Seattle is out trying to recruit nationally against, you know, dozens or hundreds of other communities and police forces across the country, overcoming that hit to our reputation, I would say, I think needs to be done by our city leaders to present a more welcoming and appreciation for law enforcement that makes a young person feel like, yeah, Seattle would be a great place to work.
Let me ask you, the group, then, this, because I think you raise a very interesting point, but one of the other things that Seattle is competing against is its own cost of housing, for example. Mm-hmm. It's a very expensive place to live. It's on $100,000 a year, much less on anything less than that. Is there anything that the city should do to subsidize law enforcement housing so, one, you can recruit more police, but also, two, you can have police who actually live in the city, which isn't the case, and the vast majority, is my understanding, don't. So is that something that the city should be considering? Although then we've got the budget issue we just spoke about earlier.
Sure. So like any other company or employer in the area, as you're trying to recruit talent, you have to look at the cost of living in your particular area. So other cities are more affordable. If Bellingham is recruiting police, the cost of living is probably close to half there than what is here. So compensation and police salaries have to take account of that. The same is true for teachers, firefighters, anyone else that you're trying to hire for the city. But the other thing to look at it, I always think of, look at it from the other way around, which is what is it about Seattle's policies, property taxes, regulations, restrictions on housing, the Growth Management Act, that make housing so unaffordable? So what is driving the rising costs, especially those limitations that are imposed by government and are under the control of the city or maybe King County? Looking at those factors would reduce the cost of housing and make it easier to attract people to live here.
David, what do you think?
Yeah, it came up sort of casually, I would say, in conversation in the city council. There has not been any proposal yet, as far as we know, to subsidize housing. I would be surprised if it ever got there because of, you know, like we talked about, the city is going to be spending a lot of money on the contract. The contract doesn't say anything about housing subsidies. But officers are going to be the best paid in the state now. Well, they haven't voted on the contract yet. If they vote to approve it, they would be the best paid in the state, and the starting salary would be $103,000. Pretty quick escalation up to $110,000. So I think for Seattle, the path of less resistance rather than subsidizing housing will be to just increase their salaries, which is what we're doing right now.
Right.
So, I don't know. I'm skeptical that it'll ever get to that point. It has come up, though.
Okay. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this message.
Support comes from Pacific Science Center, working to inspire the next generation of scientists and increase access to STEM education statewide through digital discovery workshops, science on wheels, and summer camps. More ways to support these efforts at pacsci.org. Support comes from the Discovery Inn on Washington's San Juan Island, an island getaway that's a ferry ride away, now taking reservations for summer and fall. More information and booking available at discoveryinn.com.
Welcome back to Week in Review. I'm Mike Lewis in for Bill Radke. We have City Hall reporter David Croman, Executive Director of Commute Seattle Alex Hudson, and we have Vice President of Research at Washington Policy Center Paul Guppy. Thank you all for being here. We have a slate of ballot measures in Washington State right now. The Seattle Times reports that the state's Republican Party chairperson is attempting to get three more initiatives on Washington's November ballot. The No Squatters Rights initiative, which would largely apply to situations where someone without a lease agreement is present and living on someone else's property, something has been referred to as squatting. Although, to be fair, it's been argued that the language in one of the measures would also roll back renter protections at the same time. Another initiative would end Washington's sanctuary state status by forcing law enforcement agencies in the state to cooperate with federal authorities in enforcing federal immigration law. And the third would be an end to the state's push to eliminate natural gas-fired stoves and heaters. These three join three other prominent GOP-backed initiatives that include measures to repeal the state's capital gains tax, to end the carbon trade market, and to defund the state's mandatory long-term health insurance program. Paul, what are the odds we've got? Let's just talk about the first three that I mentioned. What are the odds that these make it on the ballot in your mind?
Yeah. So as a person who spends a great deal of time in this policy area about the initiative process, it is mid to late April. It is late to try to get an initiative on the ballot for 2024. That means collecting 325,000 valid signatures by July 5th. That in practice means that you would need a cushion of at least 100,000 signatures more than that. So that is hard to get to. Without a lot of sort of natural public controversy, it's hard to get people's attention to explain the issue, and so that's the challenge. Of the three, the only one I think that would really have a shot of gaining traction with the public is the one about natural gas ban, or the bill that was passed late in the session that limits the delivery of natural gas services into the future. And the reason I say that is because it connects into a national issue that's been debated for some time. The Biden administration has had some policies related to natural gas as well. So if advocates are able to tap into that pre-existing attention that the issue is getting and get organized and get out and collect 325,000 signatures, they might make it by July. But I think it's a long shot.
Well, and not just organize, but fund it.
Yes. And it
how much takes, money does Haywood have?
$2 million? You know, yeah. It takes a lot of money to do a signature drive across the state.
Yeah. I think at this point, this is what my grandma would call feeling your oats, right? It seems like they've got a couple of wins here under their belt and are looking out there to see what else they can do.
They have three initiatives coming. Let's go for three more.
Right. And I just... It doesn't make sense to me, right? What's the end goal here? The end goal is that your houses are dirtier, your children have more asthma, like that more people are incarcerated and we have to put more money into that system. Like it just, I don't understand the worldview of what it is that these things are trying to build. And I hope that as the conversation over the next couple of months leading up to the election shows us that these are actually really not ideas that Washingtonians are wanting to get
behind. Are you referring to the three that are already qualified or the three that are proposed?
Just sort of all of the ideas, right, mm-hmm. as a sort of suite of ideas and what they would mean and change for Washingtonians and our world in 10, 15, 20 years from now. The results are the same kind of disasters that we're talking about here in terms of lack of availability to solve problems that are not getting cheaper to solve.
Let me throw this to the group then. Do you see – there's been some talk that this package of initiatives are more about a larger idea, this larger idea about making people unhappy with the status quo. Mm-hmm. And for the governor's race, because Bob Ferguson would be seen as the Democrat as the status quo, and Dave Reichert, the GOP challenger, would not be seen as the status quo necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think – David, let me ask you. Do you feel like as a package that there is a larger ambition here that isn't just program specific?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't report on this stuff, so I don't have like – I don't have any sort of reporting or deep insight into it. I will say, I mean, each of these subjects is let's call them hot button. I mean,
yeah.
They are all
mm-hmm.
– the sanctuary
city. They get
city,
a strong reaction from people.
Right. You know, sanctuary cities, that was sort of a big talking point at the beginning of the Trump administration. And, you know, I think as my colleague Claire pointed out in the story, that, you know, the quote, squatters, what do they call the squatters' rights bill?
Yes.
Or the, it, you know, that doesn't actually come up all that often, but when it does, it gets a lot of news coverage. And so, you know, I mean, it has the feeling to me of issues that feel like they are particularly emotional right now. You know, immigration, of course. I mean, even in Tukwila here in Washington State, we see a lot of asylum seekers coming through. So immigration is suddenly a big thing that people are thinking a lot about again and feel very strongly about. So on the ballot, it might have the effect of bringing people out. Again, though, I haven't talked to the initiative, the people who are putting together these initiatives. I don't know exactly what their motives are.
Alex, let me ask you then, when you see this, we've got the three that are, according to Paul, may or may not get on the ballot. It is late to be in the process of doing that.
The three new ones.
The right. Three ones that are actually already on the ballot are regarding the capital gains tax, mm-hmm. the end of the carbon trade market, and defunding the mandatory long-term care insurance program. That would not necessarily make it eliminated. It would just cut away. It would allow you to be optional.
Right.
Which essentially is going to end it, most people think. I mean, of these initiatives, is there anything in these that you see as goals specific to the initiatives, or do you feel like these are part of sort of a larger push to make people feel like the state is moving or has moved historically in the wrong direction and needs a reboot?
I think that some of these initiatives are – I mean, it's kind of a well-established point of view that some of these initiatives are on the ballots in order to drive turnout on the Republican side across the state of Washington in what is potentially going to be a more contested than usual governor's race. And I believe that part of the worldview of what comes after – like these aren't – giving kids free transit, which is one of the things that it comes from the climate, the tax and invest policy, isn't a problem that we need to solve. Making it cheaper for you to put solar power on your house isn't a problem that we need to solve. Making it so that when you are older, your grandparents get older, that you're not, you know, bankrupted over needing to put a wheelchair ramp on your house. These are not actual things that most Washingtonians think are problems. Capital gains, for example, right? What are we doing with that money? We're investing in free early learning and childcare and better schools across the state of Washington. These are things that actually people want. And so when you look at what the money is for, what we're getting, how it's improving people's lives, it's very obvious that these are popular ideas. But when you roll it all the way up into these kind of very glib one-sentence ideas, the way that the initiative process forces these conversations to be, I think it's a little disingenuous.
Let me follow up with you then, Alex. Which of these three do you think is the most likely to actually get through that portal and get passed by voters?
Like, which of these will be repealed?
No, which one? Yeah, exactly. Well, which initiative is likely to be approved?
You know, it does seem to me like the long-term healthcare one has probably got the toughest road to hoe. But that we know that the capital gains is actually quite popular. And when we talk to people about what they're getting for the, you know, the tax on polluters, that's showing strength.
All right. I'm sorry.
You could flip a three-sided coin and figure out which one is going to pass.
That's a fair point. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the other big issue of the week. Cowlitz County Superior Court Judge Gary Bashore ruled as unconstitutional Washington's ban on high-capacity firearm magazines. Quickly, the state Supreme Court issued an emergency order keeping the law on the books while the state appeals the decision. The 2022 Washington law, which is still in effect while the Supreme Court works toward a ruling, bans magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Judge Bashore, in his ruling, said the state should have considered what the framers of the Second Amendment had in mind in 1791 regarding legal limits on firearms. Said Bashore, and this is a quote, there was no appetite to limit gun rights by the founders. Though the specific technology available today may not have been envisioned, the founders expected technological advancement. This decision stems from a lawsuit Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed against Gators Guns based in Kelso for selling high-capacity magazines after the ban went into effect. David, when you look at this, where do you see the Supreme Court coming out? State Supreme Court.
I think there's a reason they put the stay in so quickly. I don't love referring to Supreme Courts as liberal or conservative or whatever, but I think you can say that this Supreme Court is more liberal than Cowlitz County judge. I mean, this is the Supreme Court that found that the state's drug possession laws were unconstitutional, and you know they've had some fairly sweeping rulings. I don't see a lot of originalists on that court who are going to spend a lot of time thinking too hard about what the framers meant in 1791. So I guess my expectation would be that the law will end up staying in place. But, it ends up, you know, we're talking about the Second Amendment here. I suppose there's a world in which it ends up at the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I don't know what path that would need to take to get there.
Paul, the most popular and common firearm in 1791 was the flintlock musket.
Yeah.
And apparently a skilled infantryman could pull off 4 rounds in a minute in ideal conditions. Is it fair for Bashore to say that the framers had a sense of what technology was to come?
Yeah, obviously the framers had no idea what technology was to come. I think that what they were thinking of was inalienable individual rights that we all have, freedom of speech, freedom to own property, and firearms was part of that, part of self-defense or just the right to own a firearm. They were also coming out of a world in which the British government had restricted who could own firearms and there were controls at the time. I think that's kind of core civil rights idea that they have in mind, which, by the way, kind of interestingly fits into Gator Guns, which deliberately violated the rule as a civil rights measure in order to create a lawsuit. And Attorney General Ferguson knew this was coming in advance, and he filed a lawsuit against the dealer in order to create the case. So that's being tested right now. So from a legal point of view, David makes a good point that the U.S. Supreme Court has been ruling on Second Amendment issues recently, and this Washington state law will almost certainly fit into those precedents in some way. Either our state Supreme Court will uphold the law and then it'll be challenged at the federal level, or the state Supreme Court, whether it's liberal, conservative, whatever, will look at U.S. Supreme Court precedents and then apply those to Washington state and say this law is unconstitutional. But that's all on the legal side. On the practical side, I actually think this law has no effect at all. So law-abiding gun owners will follow it, and people who want to break the law will do what they do with all other gun laws, which is just completely ignore them. So I don't think that a 10-round limit on a magazine is going to prevent a shooter from doing what he wants to do.
Let me ask a follow-up on that then.
Yeah.
So would that not – I mean, if you take that to its logical conclusion, there should be no restrictions. If the certain people are going to follow the guidelines and other people are just simply not.
Yeah, if you really get up into military-style destructive firearms, there's a limit on technology as to what's available. But larger magazines are commonly available everywhere. And also, even this law in Washington state doesn't forbid owning the magazine. You just can't buy one. So you can go to another state, buy it, bring it in. If you own them already, you can continue to own them. So it's a fairly mild restriction the way it is. But you make a good point regarding, you know, as you go up the scale of destructive technology, it becomes harder to access. And that should be, you know, nobody should own a machine gun or a hand grenade. There are weapons that should not be available in the public, and there's a reasonable limit there.
Yeah, and we have to try. I'm the parent of a Seattle Public School student, and we are on our third, fourth gun violence-related shutdown this year, and the year's halfway over. Like, responsible gun owners and reasonable people are actually enticed by behavior around about regulation, right? And we have a serious gun violence epidemic across our country.
But the vast majority of gun owners are not a threat to anybody. It's just a small number of people who want to do harm to others.
I totally agree.
Whether they have access to the weapon. So controlling the thing doesn't necessarily deter the person. That's where the effort should be.
It does send a message about what is acceptable and what can be expected. And I guess I just don't think it's an undue burden to have to be asked to reload clips. Like, it's not, you know, we got to try.
Okay. Honest gun owners, which is estimates are that 42% of households in Washington state have a firearm. So it's very, very common. The vast majority of people are very responsible. And you make a good point about sending a signal, okay, but the actual practical effect, I think, is very little or zero.
David, when you saw this ruling, was there any concern, or did you notice or listen to some of the talk that said this standard, essentially, if for example, Judge Bashore's ruling was to stay, that this could undercut gun restrictions virtually everywhere?
I don't know that I don't know that I'm smart enough to answer that question. I don't know. I really don't.
Quickly, which is there are restrictions that have been upheld all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court on who can own a firearm. So, and again, not so much a restriction on the object itself, but rather on the people who can have access to it. So convicted felons, people who are at a danger, have restrictions on domestic violence. Even the most ardent gun rights advocates in the country support restrictions on who's allowed to have a firearm. And so,
but not necessarily on background checks.
Advocates' concern would be who's subject to the background check and how restrictive are they.
Right.
So, but if a person has a criminal history and has shown a willingness to hurt other people, that's where the restriction can be more effective.
Alex, let me throw one last question back at you then. So as a parent person who's had to deal personally with you know, the lockdown situation in schools, do you see any pathway forward on addressing, as you're to Paul's point about not addressing the individual and not the object? I mean, do you feel like that is a way to handle this moving forward, or do you feel like you need to address both things?
It's a complex issue, and you have to address both things, right? If we had the fact of the matter is the level of gun violence that is ripping across our country and robbing people of the ones that they love is not the way it is other places. And so what are the differences in other countries, and how can we have – I said it at the top of the show, I grew up on a farm, right? I grew up around responsible gun owners, and guns were a regular part of my family upbringing.
Right.
And I also never had to get locked down in school, right? So something has changed and something has to give. A lot of smart people are thinking about this. And it really just comes back to the fact that we have a whole heck of a lot of guns in this country. And it is real easy to get your hands on them.
All right. With that, we will be back in just a moment after a short break with Week in Review. Welcome back to Week in Review. I'm Mike Lewis in for Bill Radke. If you didn't hear the lineup earlier, you're going to hear it again now. thank you, Alex Hudson. Thank you, Paul Guppy. And thank you, David Croman, for joining the show today. Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell, we're going to put this one directly on your lap, Alex. Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell has proposed a $1.3 billion transportation levy to help restore the city's transportation infrastructure. It's an extension and expansion of a current levy. Alex, what does this levy seek to do, and what can't it do?
Yeah, the Move Seattle levy, which voters passed in 2015, is investments in our transportation infrastructure. So it's dedicated funds that go directly to the Department of Transportation, and it helps with all manner of things, building and maintaining sidewalks, maintenance and preservation of our bridges, and in the last package, the delivery of several BRT rapid lines. So it's for all manner of our transportation infrastructure across the board. And so this will be a renewal and expansion. It's going to be a pretty large amount of money. It's going to be the biggest levy that Seattle voters have considered. But we know that this is really important, right?
Like, right.
Just look around. We have a lot of work to do in making sure that our bridges stay open, despite no matter how hot it is, right? That our buses are more reliable, that our sidewalks are safe, and that no one has to feel like they're taking their lives in their line to cross a busy street to go to the grocery store. And you can look around and see all the good things that are coming, right? We've got more light rail stations that are coming on. We've had these huge investments in transit service. We've got a ton of infrastructure that the last Move levy built, and we can be building on that to make sure we're meeting the needs of our growing city.
What can't it do? I think people sometimes confuse, so for example, a bridge that actually is a state responsibility as opposed to a bridge that might be at least in part a city responsibility. Perhaps you know, Alex, like what should people not expect out of this?
You shouldn't expect any new bridges. Those are real, real, real expensive. And, President Joe Biden's going to have to write some checks for us to make something like that happen. And you shouldn't expect that this is going to fix every problem. That's not the intention here. The intention is to let the Department of Transportation kind of keep cooking on the things that they've been doing a good job at and make sure that we're having better safety for folks, better connectivity, and making lives easier for Seattleites.
David, have transportation levies generally been popular in Seattle? I mean, Seattle is famous for being very willing to tax itself on a variety of things. Do you think that this transportation levy is something that is going to be popular enough to move through and have voters say absolutely?
Yeah, I make a point of not predicting these things, but I do say that I have been a reporter since 2015 and none have failed yet.
Fair enough.
And so, there's only been, Alex will correct all of my facts on this if I get them wrong, but this would be the third transportation levy in a row.
Yes,
so we don't have like a
correct, huge
sample size of how people feel about transportation levies. I remember I was at the election party of the Move Seattle one and people were really nervous. I remember getting calls before then of, pollsters and consultants and things like that where the polling apparently didn't look very good. And then it passed by 17 points or something like that. I think doubt Seattle voters at your peril. That said, transportation, there were some controversy with the last transportation package. There were some projects that were promised as part of that that got delayed or maybe even didn't happen at all. They had to downsize some of their ambitions around bridge maintenance, which bridges they were maintaining. Alex said that, it's true, this is the largest levy, but, with inflation and everything, the year-to-year spending and its buying power is going to be only marginally larger, I would say, than the one before it. So, I know there are some concerns from folks who want it to be bigger, who want it to do more. For example, sidewalks, this would continue the pace of sidewalk construction that's happening in the city right now, which is about 250 blocks a year. That would mean in 400 years or so, we would have sidewalks on every block in the city. And then, of course, on the other side, it also represents a $12 a month to the medium Seattle homeowner property tax increase. We've talked about affordability. So I think there are likely to be concerns on both ends of the spectrum, people who want it to be bigger and people who don't want it at all. But again, until Seattle voters turn down a levy, I won't be predicting any death.
Death of levy. Paul, anything on this?
Well, you just touched on the key of it right there, is that until voters turn down a levy, the city leaders are going to keep putting major chunks of the city budget, which I consider to be core services, just as you explained, regarding transportation, safety, sidewalks. They're going to continue to put them on a special 6 or 8 or 9 year levy. This is an 8 year levy. You're right that it's the third one. So it started in 2006. That levy was $365,000. Mill, thank you.
One sidewalk.
So modest.
I'm supposed to be an expert on numbers. And, you know, $365 million was that first levy, and the current proposal is $1.35 billion. Right. So it really has grown quite a bit. But again, I see this more as budget priorities that I think services like this should be funded first instead of left to be put on a temporary levy, which, again, as David is describing, can be politically risky if voters don't support it. But I foresee this pattern continuing, that core services are put on a temporary levy and regular revenue is used to fund lower priorities. And until that pattern changes, I think levies will continue to be the way to go.
I think that I take some question about whether or not this is core services. There's certainly things in there that are kind of, people will talk about me being kind of back to basics or fundamentals of our transportation system, but this is not supplanting core services. And
well, I was going to mention what I call the pothole metric, which Seattle does not seem to be doing that great on. So I would consider that basic, but go ahead with your point.
Yeah, and this is very much not supplanting its core responsibilities. It is 30% of the department's of SDOT's budget, and so it is providing a lot of services that people have now come to expect as being core.
That's right.
But I don't, and I do agree that we need more sustainable funding. I certainly wish we had a lot more available to be doing fun and amazing things to make sure that our growing city is moving people around in the ways that people want to get there. And transportation is popular, right? There was that Coma poll a couple of weeks ago that says that Sound Transit's more popular than the Seahawks. So transportation is something that people want to invest in. And why? Because every single person uses it every single day, whether you leave your house or not.
All right, let's get into a few headlines and a couple of quick reactions to those. Amazon, for the first time in its entire history in Washington State, saw a drop in the number of employees it has in Washington State. It fell by 3,000 people to 87,000 employees. And this is according to Todd Bishop, a terrific story in GeekWire, its first recorded year-over-year employment decline since the company was founded 30 years ago in Jeff Bezos' Bellevue garage. So it started as two. It's up to 87,000, but it started to drop. Does anyone here see a concern about this, or is that something that actually is, that leveling off is maybe a good thing? Paul, you first.
Great point. I do see it as a potential concern. And again, I'm in the policy world, I'm always looking for early indicators that show a trend that could be concerning for Washington State in the future. And this follows on another great Washington-based company, Boeing, shifting its future manufacturing off into other states. And that's been going on for about 15 years now. And Boeing moved their headquarters out of Seattle as well. So then when I see another big successful corporation, big job producer, begin where employment growth in that same article reports that in other places, employment growth for Amazon is increasing, but then tapering down in Washington State, it makes me worry about the business climate and our state's ability to continue to attract great jobs, investment, and entrepreneurs to produce the next great innovative company that's waiting out there. I want that growth, and I'm sure everybody does, want that growth to happen here, and for us to continue to be on the leading edge and not lose our reputation for being a great place to start a business, and then that future growth ends up tapering off to someplace else.
David, when you see Amazon employment declining in Washington State, do you think that this is something that the city is going to react to in a negative way, or is there going to be a component that says, finally, the pressure on Seattle from a whole bunch of people moving in, a whole bunch of people with high incomes moving in, that pressure is going to have, is there a benefit to that, or is this mostly bad news that Amazon employment is declining in Seattle, or is declining in Washington State, rather?
Well, it kind of bookends our whole conversation here, which is it's not good for the city's revenue forecast when employment is slowing. I do think, I mean, tech in general has been dragging more than the rest of the economy on a whole. I think part of that is because they expanded so much in the early days of the pandemic when everybody was ordering online. I'd be curious to know what that number today is compared to that number in late 2019. I imagine my guess is it's still quite a bit larger than it was. But nonetheless, if you're a Seattle city official in City Hall, news of declining employment is never a good thing.
All right, we'll switch to one more headline, and then we're going to go to our smile. King County's 10 health centers will most of King County's 10 health centers will have to close next year. This is a KUW story. Next year, unless the county comes up with a budget fix soon. Alex, bad news?
Terrible news. Terrible news. That hobgoblin Tim Iman strikes again in terms of limiting the amount of property tax that the county can collect and making it so that we can't deliver these core services that people count on. And I just cannot underscore both the moral tragedy it would be if these public health centers that serve people who have basically no other access to care close, as well as the extreme level of kind of costly damage that that's going to do to what it looks and feels like to be a member of this community.
All right, we're running out of time here. We're going to jump into our smile. Before we end this week's show, let's talk apples and apples. Washington apple growers are looking for the name of the state's newest apple. If you remember the last big apple drop, it was the Cosmic Crisp. And before I ask the panelists for their thoughts, a quick thanks to Kitsap County Librarian Karina Langstrett, who suggested we tackle this pressing issue here on Week in Review. Alex? Sorry, you're on the...
I got it.
You got it?
Pink Flamingo.
Mm. Oh, awesome. That's actually kind of a nice name. Mm-hmm. Little jealous on that one. All right, Paul?
You said this variety was developed at WSU?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. So they could call it the Pullman Pulpy, which maybe would not be great marketing.
Yeah, pulpy.
I'm not sure you're going to win this one.
I was thinking of Golden Tasty would be nice to pick up with Red Delicious and what you said, Pink Flamingo, which I think is great. But maybe they should just go with calling it The Professor.
All right.
As it comes out of a university.
I do kind of like that. All right, David.
I've gotten kind of grinchy about all the names of new apples. Like, there's one that's like ends in a Z, and I feel like they're getting a little too out over their skis on some of their names. So I want something like the Cougar, you know, like if it's made in WSU, something really like, or maybe we could just like make a new Red Delicious, because Red Delicious, I'd be happy. We could retire Red Delicious.
Retire the old one.
And just supplant it with a better
more delicious.
Red Delicious.
My selection is the Pomeroy.
That's nice.
The Pomeroy is, not only is it an Eastern Washington town near the apples, it's the old English term means one who dwells by an orchard.
Oh,
wow. So there you go. So if I'm going for the Pomeroy, let's get some listener suggestions. John in West Seattle offered Appley, Mick Applehead. Of course you did, John. Daniel in Beacon Hill said the Sweet Alpenglow. Oh, I kind of like that one. Mm-hmm. Another listener suggested Sasquatch's Pink Blush. And then some wazoo names, of course. Carrie and Burian and Robert and Capitol Hill both suggested Cooged It. Mm. And Seth in Fremont suggested the Crimson Cider. And maybe my favorite of the suggestions came from Week in Review producer Kevin Kniestat. His suggestion, the Pac-2 Crunch. Or maybe the Tupac Crunch.
That's pretty good.
All right. That is a show for today. Thank you for joining us on Week in Review. Executive Director of Commute Seattle, Alex Hudson, thank you for coming. Vice President for Research at Washington Policy Center, Paul Guppy, thank you for showing up, Paul.
Yep.
Seattle Times City Hall reporter, who always brings the bad news, David Croman, thank you so much for showing up on the show again. Week in Review is produced by Kevin Kniestat. Social media and live streaming is Juan Pablo Chiquiza. Kathy Faulkner is running the board today. I am Mike Lewis.